I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome, everybody, to this special edition of the Motorsport Magazine podcast, part of our 100th anniversary series that marks a very significant year in the history of the original racing magazine. To celebrate motorsport hitting the magic ton and its founding as the Brooklands Gazette in the summer of 1924, we'll be bringing you a very special podcast every month throughout 2024. We've invited some gilt-edged motorsport heroes and longtime friends of the magazine to relive the key moments of their racing lives, which of course have been covered by this magazine for decades. This, we hope, will give us a glimpse of what motorsport, both the way of life and the magazine, has meant to these people throughout their careers. I'm your host, Rob Widdows, and today my special guest is Derek Bell. Good morning, Derek.
Good morning, Derek. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much. You're very punctual, very, very punctual.
Oh, I always am, Rob. You know me.
I know you. Yep, I should know you by now. Right, Derek, we are doing a podcast to celebrate the centenary of Motorsport magazine.
Yes.
Before I get into that, I'm going to just take you back to 2009 when you told Simon Taylor in Motorsport magazine about your first ever race win at Goodwood. So I thought it's a good place to start because it set the scene for an amazing career. So if you could just start off by taking us back to that weekend at Goodwood.
Yes. Yeah. Well, obviously, really, it's like, you know, how did your racing career start and why? And where did it come from? And I guess briefly as I can make it, as far as I can go back, it goes back to when I was 9 years old, working on the family farm at Pagham, Church Farm. And of course, like any young lad, all I wanted to do was drive the tractors and jeeps and not be hurling manure around on the end of a fork. I wanted to drive tractors and everything. So that's how it started. And by the time I was 15, 16, I was quite adept at driving and would drive anything that moved. And even with my dear stepfather, the colonel, who was a major part of my life, he used to say to me, wash my car. And it was his XK150 or wherever it happened to be. And I'd wash his car and then I'd take it on the road to Chichester and back to see if I could get 100 miles an hour on that straight past the nurseries. Which, of course, when you consider it today, you go, it must have been bloody crazy. But there weren't any cars on it, and there were no people buying their vegetables at the village shop. So I was 100 mile an hour was a piece of cake, really. So that's how it started. And I never crashed at that point. And so I always had a passion for speed. And, of course, Goodwood was just an earshot away, as you well know. And so I used to go to Goodwood as a corner worker, as a marshal, around the time that I got my license. And I was 17, I got it like the day I could. And then, of course, it was like, well, what are you going to do next? And the only thing I could really do was to go to a driving school. So I went to the Jim Russell Racing Driver's School, which was obviously the only school really in England at the time. And went up to Norfolk, which is 180 miles from sunny old Pagham, which couldn't be further south if it tried within the UK. And I used to go up and down there. I went up, I probably only went five times. But of course, in those days, I would come around to be running the farm, the family farm, £20 a week, which didn't go very far, as you can imagine. And but I used to raise a bit of money and I went, you know, on my own working and used to go to the Russell School, probably went five, six times. And that particularly what became the last time I went, we were lapping at around about 7,500 revs. It wasn't ever at the big revs that we were allowed to. you had to go, you went up 500 revs every time, you went out every five or 10 laps, or every 50 quid, whichever way you look at it. And and I remember at the end of this particular run, you know, Jim was talking to the 8 or 10 of us about standing by the different cars. We weren't in them. We were standing around in a group. And he said, who was in that car over there? And I pointed at it. And he said, oh, and he just took me to one side in front of, but in front of everybody, and just said, you know, blah, 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 you've got a great future. I guarantee within a year, you'll be in a factory team. And those are his wonderful words, which of course every young driver wants to hear. But of course, that was great hearing it, but where the hell I was going to get the money to buy the car or to get my backside in a car to go to race to prove to anybody that I could do it. Anyway, I came back home 180 miles down back to Pagham. And of course, I walked into my parents' house and my stepfather said to me, so, I mean, remember, I wasn't that old then. I was 22 or something. And he said to me, or 21, actually. And he said to me, you just proved to me you've got the ability and I'll help you. I said, Jim said he'll talk to you on the phone. He said, bring your father up here. I'll show him how good you are. I said, he'll never get in a car and come up to Norfolk. So, and the old man just said, you know, you proved to me you've got the ability and I'll help you. So that's really, and he kept to his word. But of course, I didn't have the wherewithal to start, even the brains to get around the budget to go racing. I mean, I couldn't even think about it. And then fortunately, a guy who became a lifelong friend, John Penfold from Arundel, they were the agricultural engineers there. And John one day came in my early days of my farming. So now we're probably up to, I was 23. And John, and having only sat in the cars at the racing school as such, which was not very often. And John got chatting about our lives and what we'd done. And he was a similar age to me. So he said, well, why don't we do it together? So he then put up a budget. We bought a Lotus 7 or built a Lotus 7. And that was it. And we actually were working on it the night before. we went out to race on March the 13th, 1964. And of course, it was, can you imagine, March isn't the best month of the year in Britain. It was freezing cold. And of course, we didn't have a roof on the car. And at this point, we had no fenders or mudguards. And we were due to race the next day. And John said, well, you take it out, chap, give it a run, sort of run the engine. I mean, it was a Cortina 1500 GT engine. And he said, take it out, give it a run, and you know, we'll, overnight, we'll rivet on the mudguards, so you have those for the race tomorrow. And I went, anyway, I did my run, but I was so bitterly cold and bitterly wet. So I brought it back after about 30, 40 miles. I got about as far as Midhurst and turned around and came home. And then the next day we went to Goodwood, and you know, I remember doing some practice, and of course it was a handicap race. And so they'd obviously seen my lap times or whatever, however one would in the rain. But the highlight really to me was the fact that Stirling Moss Automobile Racing Team, SMART, had their beautiful green truck there with a beautiful Brabham BT8, which Hugh Dibley, who was a wonderful driver in that era, and Hugh was going to drive the car for Stirling. Amongst us, we lot of real sort of hopeless, you know, hopers at the back. And of course, he started right at the back in scratch, and I was halfway down the group. And I never saw him the whole race. And I, in fact, didn't see very many cars at all. Didn't overtake much that I can remember. I mean, I passed a lot on the grass. I wasn't on the grass. They were spinning away like tops. And we got to the last lap. It was only five laps. And I came around and John managed to scrounge a lap board off somebody. We didn't even need a lap board. So he hung the board out and says, P1, L1, meaning I had one lap to go. And I was in the lead. And I just burst into laughter. I couldn't believe it. And I went round the whole of the last lap, trying not to go off the road. Suddenly realised it was all rather serious. And went over the line and we won it. And I won this beautiful alarm clock that sadly, where I am right now, I can't show you, but I have it back up. Hang on. And that was my sort of first win. And so I was soaked. Everybody was soaked. And so we loaded up the car with, you know, the petrol, the 5-gallon, you know, jerry can and the tool kit and bits and pieces. And I drove it back down to Pagham. We put it in the barn and that was it. But I did win my first race. And I finished second in the championship actually that year. But obviously, because of budgets and everything, we couldn't do all the races because I was, you know, farming. And Pagham's a long way from anywhere, apart from Chichester. And so, of course, consequently, any race was north of, you know, north of Horsham. So you know, it was really tough going. But we had a great season. And I finished second in the Lotus 7 championship.
It's a great story. It is. It's a great story when you think about what came over the following decades. Before we go any further, can I ask you, do you remember when you first became aware of Motorsport magazine? Because obviously you were very keen on cars, on racing. You lived, as you say, right next to Goodwood. Was it in the house? Was it in the family? Or did you have to go out and buy it or what?
No, I had to go and buy it. And my step, the Colonel, my stepfather, who I've lived with, and thank God, you always have somebody in your life that helped you. And he certainly did help me, although not in the beginning. As he had said to me, you prove to me you've got the ability and I will help you. But he relied on me to go and get myself sorted out. Yet he came to my first race at Goodwood and followed me in lots of the races that season. But you know, we didn't take Motorsport magazine, but obviously in those days you travel by train quite a lot to go to London and other places. And of course, I'd only just left college or university at Cirencester. So, I was used to being on trains. So W.H. Smith and Sons became very useful for buying Motorsport because it was really the only magazine in those days. But I remember it vividly. It was the magazine. I mean, I don't know who was the first magazine, but it can't be many that were out there much longer than the Motorsport.
And also, that's great because little did you know that you would appear in it almost every month at the height of your career. So that was that.
It's fantastic. It's fantastic, Robin. In fact, not here, but back at Pagham, there's a picture because Autosport had us on the front page. And I was doing an interview back in England the other week. And as I looked across the room, there was this frame picture. I think it was given to me, but it just says Bell makes it five. It was fantastic. It was And I'm sure that was Motorsport. I think it was. Anyway, if it wasn't, it should have been. But it was lovely. We had a lot of the British press were really good to us. But we needed it because there was the TV was non-existent on racing. So if the magazines didn't slap it out there, we weren't going to get really recognised for any reason at all.
Okay, your stepfather Bernard Hender, who supported you so much. It was actually him who enabled you to go racing in Europe in Formula 3 and Formula 2 at a time when it was a bit like being a gypsy. I mean, there was just a van, a trailer and a racing car. It must have been an amazing experience for you as a young man.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. I don't know how long we got on this show, Rob, but the thing is that, when you get down to it, I've often thought, I wish somebody, rather like you're doing now, had written a book or a feature about how the drivers that made it, how they started. Because I've no idea how Tom Christensen started. I don't know. I know Jackie X started on motocross bikes or trials bikes. But to know how guys actually got into racing, Brian Redmond borrowed his mother's car, Frank Williams nicked his mother's A35 and that sort of thing. And you talk to John Fitzpatrick about the stories of where they got the cars from, borrowed mum's car for the weekend, but said they were going shopping and they'd knock the wheel hubcaps off and go and do a race at Alton Park. And, that's what it was like. And so none of us know how all we know is, saw you on the grid in Monaco, saw you on the grid in Silverstone. And you never know how actually people got going before that, really. Even when you've been racing with people a long time, as I've just mentioned. But for me, the moving on up became very difficult because once I'd done the Lotus 7 year, it was like at the end of the year, the chap, John Upson, who came, everybody appears out of the woodwork. They're in the village, they're in Bognor, they're in Chichester. And the guy comes up and says, hello, mate. He said, I'd love to come down and see your car sometime. They come down and you find out that he used to work at UDT Laystall and balancing engines. And you go, I'd love to come and work, odd night here and there. And that's how all these things. It was George Brown, who was the same Ray Wardell, who was a young lad who worked at Hare Spares in Littlehampton with Mike Earle. And we all sort of come together and you end up with this wonderful nucleus of great enthusiasts. I'm sure everybody got a bit of money at the end of it because they had to, but we never did it for the money. We did it because of the passion to be in racing cars. And it was those early days that, of course, were so vital to, I think, how we became better people all round and some of us were successful.
You did extremely well in in Formula 3 and in Formula 2 up against actually some very, very, very good races. In fact, you were, I think you were in the Formula 2 race at Hockenheim when Jim Clark lost his life, weren't you?
Yeah, yes. I mean, I don't know, that was the second race of the year. It wasn't the first. Barcelona, we had a problem with the clutch. And then we did another, I think, Thruxton. And I think I was on the front row grid, or I finished in the top three anyway of the race on Easter Monday meeting. And the big meeting of the year, the one that I used to relish at Goodwood, you know, which used to be the big meeting there. And everything to me was related around Goodwood. And it's probably Goodwood's fault that I ever went racing, to be frank, if we did not know it. But yes, I was at Hockenheim that day, quite obviously, because it was the third round of the world of the European Championship. And my dear Colonel and I were staying at the hotel down the road from Hockenheim, yeah, on the edge of the River Rhine. And we were having a cup of tea on the Saturday afternoon, bucketing down with rain. And and just the two of us and no other people in the hotel, I don't know why. And then in walks Jimmy Clark and Graham Hill. I mean, my eyes fell out on Chappell's hat. It was like, oh my lord, there are my two heroes. And it was unbelievable. I had met Graham, obviously, at some event or other, but I'd never met Jimmy. So we all sat and had a cup of tea. And it was the most remarkable sort of, at that time of my life, even now, it still stands out, particularly after what happened, how special that really was. And we chatted for probably an hour and a half. And it was just wonderful for me. And I remember at a certain point, Jimmy looked at me and said, oh, where did you qualify? So I went, fourth. I said, oh, well, where did you qualify then? He said, I was seventh. And Graham said, yeah, and I was eighth. I went, oh my goodness, gosh, I'm ahead of Jimmy Clark on the grid. And of course we went into the race, and that was Jimmy went out earlier on, and that was it. But a tragedy, something that really set me back mentally. And I've always wondered why I had the mentality to be able to stand people that I knew and liked and almost worshipped getting hurt, killed, or whatever, and still carrying on. I never quite understand that. And fortunately, nobody's tried to take me to task and check my brain. But there's lots of us, we all were carried on because that was our life, was racing, and weren't we lucky?
The thing is, I do want to ask you about that, because back in those days, the danger was a very big part of the sport, and a lot of people lost their lives. Didn't you ever think, wouldn't I be better off back on the farm rather than doing something that is satisfying but very dangerous?
Not really, no. I was reminded about it on several occasions, and people from all over the place, you know, I mean, people might be well-wishers, well-meaning friends, family, relations, would say, I say, oh boy, why didn't you sort of take up something a bit more sort of sensible, you know, get out of this fancy life you lead of swanning around the world racing. I mean, this is early days when there was no swanning going on. I mean, it was really serious stuff. And, you know, when you get a job and sort of try and become a lawyer or a doctor or something, I mean, do something useful in your life, were the quotes I used to get. And I was going, but I'm doing what I love. Aren't I lucky to be able to do it? How many of us do what we really love? And so that was my only retort. But I thought about the incidents, as you can imagine. I mean, after that, there were many, 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 many hideous crashes which I was not involved with, but sort of around at the race or certainly read about it. I don't know. Sometimes when I talk about it like now, I suddenly go, well, actually, poor, it's an awful thing to say, but I actually never saw anybody dead. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And maybe that made a difference. Maybe about seeing a guy laying over the top of a guardrail with a broken back or something, it might have sort of got hold of me and made me think, oh my God, that could have been you. Mm. And you know, it could have been you. But I know that every time I went by a spot where somebody had his accident, particularly at Le Mans, and he went by for 24 hours, yeah, where, yeah, somebody had an accident, maybe even earlier in the race, it was pretty hideous. And it was a job there, but you certainly didn't take any chances at that point. Yeah. Not that I'd like to say that we probably didn't take chances, but we were driving to the limit. Maybe we backed off a bit, but yeah, it never crossed my mind to ever stop. I mean, I was, and when I think about it, you know, my wife and then latterly Misty and that, and my family all around me, you know, it was terribly selfish. Mm. No wonder none of us could really keep our marriages together, you know, leaving that stress on our wives. It was pretty tough.
Can you explain why you have never been badly hurt in a racing car over many, many decades? That's exceptional in some ways. I think your reputation was always for incredible consistency, being able to look after the car. Almost, I could put it like winning at the slowest speed, if you like.
The last bit of that, I'm not too happy, but you're about slowest speed. But no, I mean, it seemed that I gained something with John Wire. Dear old John was an amazing man to work for. And I drove for him really from 68, if Ferrari had let me race for him in the Ford GT, because I had a test driver Thruxton. But Mr. Ferrari, strange enough, would release me to drive for Ford at Le Mans that year. I didn't know all about the hassle going on in the background. In other words, Ford versus Ferrari. But and John Wire was a very wise man, and he was like having a headmaster, actually. I used to call him the head schoolmaster. And we had so many amusing times, an amazing character, and very technically savvy, and of course, you know, I think a very sensible, serious man, and a great tactician. I think he's the way he analyzed the race and put things into gear at the right time, you know. And anyway, John just taught me such a heck of a lot. And I think he sort of got my head around this fact of trying to be safer and that sort of thing. You've got to bring the car home at all costs. Yeah. And as everybody says, you know, you don't win until first of all, you have to, you know, to see the checkered flag sort of thing. Yeah. And I remember, I think one particular race, I remember I brought the car home with sort of, you know, a broken shock absorber and no brakes on the front and that sort of thing. One of the Mirage races, even the year that we won the 75 win with Jackie, which was a wonderful time. When the car was really quite wrecked by the end of it mechanically. There wasn't, you know, not, it was pretty, the only comfortable part was the seat and the steering seemed to work properly, but it was difficult. But I got a reputation for some reason, though, the car's falling apart, we want to finish the race, let's put Derek in it. It didn't mean to say that I would win in it, but it would mean that I would bring it home. Yeah. And it sort of happened, and it ended up with that reputation coming over here to the States quite a bit.
If we could fast forward a bit, you just mentioned Enzo Ferrari. You were signed up by Ferrari at what was just the wrong time, really, because the company was in financial turmoil. They didn't have a great car at the time. And I wondered whether, despite the disappointment of not getting a full-time Formula One drive with them, did you gain something from that experience as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, I know you've heard me tell you, I've told you before, so it's like saying, just look up your book, Rob, because I've told you before. But, you know, it's something I love to repeat, because obviously to drive for Mr. Ferrari, really, I mean, if you talk to Lewis Hamilton today, he'd probably say, yes, I'd jump at it. Only because you're in your history would go down, I race for Mr. Ferrari, okay, for Enzo. I mean, how many people have done that? How many Brits have raced for Enzo? And to drive for what I consider the man that's the most famous, most infamous name in motoring, if not certainly in motorsport, I was very, very fortunate. And to get that phone from Keith Ballisette at Shell saying, would you come for a test drive with Ferrari in the Formula 2 at Crystal Palace, which is, you probably remember that, I don't know if you do, but that's how it started. Yeah. And so I was all set to drive at Crystal Palace on the Monday, after big Formula 2 International on the Saturday and Sunday, I was in my little Brabby there. And of course, they wanted me to hang on a Monday and drive. And as it happened, Jackie Yicks crashed the car, or damaged the car anyway, such that I didn't have a car to race. And it's funny that Jackie and I should end up being the closest of friends 20, 30, 40 years later, basically. Yeah. Having him almost screwing up my Formula 1 career if ever I had one. And so anyway, I thought, well, that's it, just my bloody luck, you know, I didn't get the test drive, I won't hear anymore, because it only sort of comes down the line through the engine, the manager of the track that day says, I'm afraid Jackie's crashed the car, that's that. So I went home feeling very, I thought, you know, I needed the brakes. It seemed like you never got a break at our age, nothing seemed to come right the way you wanted it. There were several situations when you go, yeah, why didn't it just roll, the dice roll my way? Yeah. But as it happened, it rolled pretty well for me the rest of my life, even though I did have some ups and downs. And then, of course, I had the call from Keith Ballisette, you know, about 10 days later, saying, would you come to Monza and do a test there? So that's how it came about. And I had my test at Monza along with a dozen other drivers. And somehow I got the drive. I'll never know to this day what time I did. But the strange thing was, when I went back to do the Formula 2 race, 4 weeks later, I was on pole position out of 50 cars. So I guess I must have gone quite well in my test, or else I was stupid enough that I just didn't know the limits. But I think I always felt I knew the limits. But so that's really how it started. And of course, then I went back to the factory that night, stayed at the hotel, the Royal Finney, and then met Enzo the next morning.
I mean, that is a boyhood dream. Lunch with Enzo Ferrari.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can probably see behind me, you know, you can see the red Ferrari right there. I mean, I've got opposite lock on at Alton Park in the damp, you know. I mean, look at it, red. There's nothing foul on it. There's no advertising. There's no nasty accoutrements to give it more ground effect. I mean, God, we got a wing on it. That's something, isn't it? You know, and it was special. It was incredible to get to drive that car. And any time I see it or get in it, you know, to drive one in a test somewhere, it's just like going back to my youth, really. Well, of course, it is or was.
Derek, I've got to ask you, had you got that Formula One drive with Ferrari or with another team, do you think you would have been tough enough, ruthless enough, selfish enough to have made the very best of it? Because Formula One always has been, you know, it's all about you. And we know that people who've won world championships, they do tend to be quite ruthless people.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the fact I'm still here proves that I made the right decision, whatever it was or when it was. But the problem, at the time I thought, I'm not good enough. I'm just not good enough. But then you have to remember, I have to remember that, again, I'm going back just a year or two, but you've got to realize that I was in Formula 3 at the end of 1967. I'd won 8 European races. I'd won at the end of 67. That was December. But by June 68, I'd gone into Formula 2, done 3 or 4 races, and gone into Formula 1 with Ferrari. So in a way, I came on pretty bloody quickly, suddenly. And you might well say, people say, well, that was because so-and-so crashed out, somebody else died. And you go, well, yes, I know. I'm not saying I didn't deserve to be there. But I think I deserve to get that shot at Ferrari, the same as Brian Redman had and Chris Williams had, and not Chris, Jonathan Williams. And others, you know, I think they were looking for, he was always looking for a new driver. I mean, you've got to realize that after Jimmy Clark's incident, within 2 or 3 weeks, I had John Cooper onto me to test Formula One, which I did. I had Ferrari onto me to drive Formula Two and Formula One. I'd been at Silverstone, and Colin Chapman had said, would you like to hop in this Indy car and test with us with Graham at Silverstone with a car going to Indy? And then on top of that, I had a John Wyatt ask me to drive the GT40 at Le Mans that year. Pretty big names asking me to drive at a certain point. Either there was nobody else out there racing, or I was the only one they could pick on, I don't know. But I was quite in demand. The problem was, the press almost didn't know about it. We didn't have managers. We had nobody out there shouting and saying, I say, I've got this young star, you must give him a chance. I don't know whether I was a young star or not. I know that I did a good old job. I mean, to get pole in my first race, you know, for Ferrari, and to lead and to win, at Zandvoort in my second race, I get pole there at Ericssoni and everybody in F2 and lead the race, and then in the 1-1 race and finished about fourth in the second because something wrong with the clutch, the gearbox. But, you know, those sort of things. And so I had to have been quite good, but I didn't necessarily shine. But then how often? I didn't have this sort of experience. I mean, I remember I went to my first Grand Prix at Monza, and Chris Amon was in the team, obviously with Ferrari. So was Jackie Ipps, and I was the additional one for the one race. They're allowed to bring a third car in, and Chris is on the front row, Jackie's on the second row, just one place ahead of me, and I'm on the third row. But I'd done that today and been, you know, within one position of Jackie Ipps or a guy of his ilk, next to Jackie Stewart and Denny Hulme on the third row of the grid, people would have said I had quite a strong future. Now, the question you asked me, did I have enough go to make me win and take those chances? I don't know. I'll never know. All I know is I'm here. And whatever risks I took, they were fairly calculated. And I don't know any more than that. I mean, there were obviously times you went, "Oh, whoa, that was close." I mean, can you imagine lapping at Spa? I mean, I believe I still hold the lap record in the line 17 round the old Spa track at 161 miles an hour. Bloody 161. I mean, they went balmy over one of the Porsches going 151 this year, last year, around the shorter circuit, albeit. But the old one didn't have guardrails. It had barbed wire fences.
Yeah.
So I must have had some sort of balls or something to maybe do that. I don't know what it was. But, you know, well, I did like... So anyway, I could go on for hours about it. And I just don't know. All I know is I'm still here. Yeah. And the only opportunity I really had was to go and drive at the end of 71, having the Porsche team stop, the 917 year was over. David York said, "Come on, old son," he said, "I'm taking you and we're going to go to Brabham." And he was taking Martini and Rossi's flat money because they were on one of the Porsche teams, not ours. But they remember the 917 era was over. So he got to know the Rossi brothers, the two Count Rossis, and they were keen to have me on the team. And David said, "We're going to go to Brabham and you're going to be my driver." And I was going to go and drive with Carlos Reutemann at Brabham. And that was a wonderful car. I mean, you know, Carlos won a couple of races. And I wouldn't go as far as to say, but I don't think I ever got beaten by Reutemann in Formula 2 the preceding years. You know, it was like that. So I know that I could have done well in that car. Whether, you know, I could have got on to win championships, I don't know. But I don't know. All I know is I'd love to have had that chance. But the one thing I do finally know is that I made the right decision, or by them going to Techno to build that awful car. As it happened, you know, I didn't get the drive and I stayed, you know, and then I carried on racing for another 30 years and I had a blast.
As far as I know, you never had any real desire to race at Le Mans. And yet that race became an absolutely huge part of your life. In the early 1970s, can you tell us a bit about what it was like racing at Le Mans? I mean, no chicanes on the straight, an absolutely magnificent circuit, the fastest sports cars in the world. Tell us a bit about those days when it just all came right for you.
Yes, it's, again, exactly. I mean, as David Hobbs again, there's that jammy sod Bell's got the decent drive again. But you have to throw his name in now and again because he doesn't get mentioned otherwise. But no, seriously, he's a wonderful guy. And, but, you know, I remember my first drive in sports car was with Jack Swatters at Spa, and because in the 512 Ferrari, and because of that, Mr. Ferrari said, "Hey, you better come back into my team and drive for me at Le Mans." I didn't want to do it because he basically screwed up my Formula One career. And eventually, I remember I flew to Brussels to see Jacques and say, "Do you know, why should I drive for Mr. Ferrari? You're the one that gave me the break in sports cars and got me a sort of reputation in one race." And he said, you've got to go to Ferrari. He said, "If you don't run for Mr. Ferrari, I won't get any spare parts for my car." so that was that. And I had to drive, you know, for the factory. And I remember the one for Ronnie Peterson. It was a fabulous weekend and something I'd have never missed to know Ronnie so well, because we raced together in F2 a lot. And it was just fabulous. And that's the great thing about those eras. And I know how we talked about the accident side of things, but there were some magic moments with the drivers that I raced with, against, whether in the same team or not. But there's some really fabulous guys out there. And you knew a lot of them, Rob. You know, it was very special. Mm. But you know, to me, Le Mans was obviously great to go to do something I never had the great desire to do. I just wanted to be a Grand Prix driver. But when you get over that, you're spat out sideways and you're not driving very good cars on the odd occasions in F1. You go, you know, and that's what used to sort of keep me going, really, was that on a weekend, I remember it vividly, we were at Watkins Glen, and I put one car on pole, and then I got in the training car and put that next to me. And next to that was Aunt Mario Andretti and the other team car with me, well, not with me, but in the same team as me. But I got ahead of Andretti, who was a sort of Formula One world champion, and I was there in sports cars. And I thought, you know, I'm still driving quite well because, you know, there I was, you know, in there, in the mix, still pushing it against Formula One drivers in sports cars. And they might say, "Oh, well, he's very good in sports cars." Well, I guess I was, but they all had the chance. They did lots of hours in them. And I think this is what we forget, is how many years racing somebody like Andretti had over me. He probably started racing 5 years before me. He might, you know, and that's what the whole thing at these early years is how much experience you've got. You've got to go along. You know, that's why nowadays these young guys are fantastic. You know, they're driving carts aged eight. Yeah. And then by the time they're 16, I mean, they're world champions in everything they get in because they're so good. I never sat in a race car till I was 23. Yeah.
I think it was the Porsche 956 that came along at just the right time for you, actually, wasn't it? Because the 917 by that time was well, it was history really by then. And the 956 was almost a gift to you because it did a great job for you and you did a great job for it.
Yes, you're totally right. But I know you skipped over it. But that 10 years, although I nearly retired in 79, I was about to retire. I went back to home in Pagamon. I went, what's the point of carrying on? I'm not earning anything. I'm not driving any decent cars. Because sports cars, if you remember, Rob, we're in the doldrums in the mid 70s. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was lucky enough to drive for Alfa Romeo with Pescarolo, and we ended up winning the world championship with the Alfa T33. I mean, what an amazing car. That year also, I won the Mall with Jackie in the Mirage. You go, well, that isn't a bad year. And then 2 years later, I'm racing for Renault Alpine for 2 years at the Mall, the only non-Frenchman in the whole team. And, you know, although we'd never won, we were leading it till about breakfast time on the Sunday morning, Jabouille and I. And so, you know, every time you got in something good, you left a good result. And then, of course, I then thought, that's it, I'm retiring. There's nothing, the future is lousy. And then I think one of the greatest sort of most generous moves I ever had in my life was dear old Steve O'Rourke appears, of the Pink Floyd. And he phones me up, who I didn't know him, I knew the Floyd, of course. And he phones me up and says, hey, old chap, he said, why didn't you come and drive a Lancia's with me in the World Championship next year in 1980 or 81? And I said, you wouldn't want to run private Lancia's. So driving running a private Italian car is not an easy thing to do. You've got to be with the factory team. I'd learned over the previous 10 years, but just by watching. And so he said, okay. He said, you got any ideas? I said, yes. So I shot up to London on Monday. We had a chat. And I said, you should drive. Let's run a BMW M1 and so on and so forth. So he said, oh, good idea. He spoke to BMW and they said, yes, we'd love to help. And of course, I had raced for BMW previously in the factory BMW team, which we had talked about in the touring car team back in 73 or 4. And along with Hans Stuck and Ronnie Peterson and John Fitzpatrick Brian Redman. And, you know, there I was. So BMW knew of me. And so, you know, it was great and natural that, you know, they should think it was a good program. And, of course, that was what I was going to do. And then by chance, I happened to get the chance to drive in the Porsche 936. I think it was 1980 at Le Mans, out of the blue. It was 81. And it was a one-off drive. And Porsche said, that is great. We put you with Jackie Hicks. And off we went. And of course, we won Le Mans in the Jules car. Yeah. And because of that, of course, I sort of suddenly got myself up on the top of the mound again. And Porsche was saying, well, we better keep the Hicks-Bell relationship going, whether it's with Jochen Mass or whoever it is within the two cars team. And of course, I went on with Jackie and won it and so on. And later on, of course, with Stuckey and everything. So yeah. We won it five times. But it was, you know, I wasn't in the doldrums for long. And I wasn't contemplating retiring for very long. But it was a dodgy period at the end of the 70s.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
70s.
It's a good thing you didn't go back to the farm in Pagham in Sussex. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about your career now, would we? Can we talk about some of the people that you raced with? If I just say a name, I'd just like you to give your immediate response. And I'm going to start with Joe Siffert.
Joe basically was, apart from Ronnie Peterson, Joe was the first teammate that I had for any length of time, because Ronnie and I just did the one race at Le Mans. And then from that, of course, Joe and I did the two-thirds of the 917 season in 71. And I got to know him very well. But it was strange because Pedro Rodriguez was in the other car with Jackie Oliver. And we had some wonderful races. But it was funny. John Wye used to dictate who was going to win. I mean, he never said in Barcelona, in when we won in Buenos Aires, my first race, Derek's going to win, or with Seppi. We were in front and they would leave it like that. And basically, that's what they did. But the one race that really got me going was at Spa, when Joe and I got pole position myself at Spa in 71. And I caught up Jackie Oliver in the other car. It's only a 4-hour race in those things, because we were doing 155, you know, average. And I remember David York or John Wye wouldn't let me overtake Ollie. And he kept me behind him for a whole bloody hour. And then every time I went by the pits, right on his tail, they knew what I was doing, because I'd already caught up, you know, 12, 15 seconds. And I just sat on his tail, and they just kept putting a board out and waving a finger at me as I went by. And so I had to stay behind. And I was really disappointed, because I got the fastest lap. Actually, no, I think Pedro might have got the fastest lap, but I got fastest in qualifying. So, you know, and Joe was part of that. And he was a fabulous guy. He was, you know, we used to talk, his philosophy was, you remember him saying to me, well, he said, so are you driving Formula One next week at the Grand Prix? Because they used to alternate weekends, if you recollect. And I said, oh, I haven't got to drive, you know. He said, oh, I said, well, I don't want to drive that car. It's not very much chance of winning in that. He said, no. He said, you drive everything that comes along. You never know, that one car might come along, that the tires will be right at the right moment, and you'll go out and you can win. And he did, I mean, if he taught me something, but he made me do things like that, because you think there could be that moment. It might be wet, and I was always good in the wet, and it might be that moment I was on the right tires and the car just happened to do the job. Anyway, it never really happened, but that was Joe. He put me in that frame of mind.
Yeah, interesting. Pedro Rodriguez.
Yeah. I never raced with Pedro as a teammate. I just had him in the other car, as you know. And he was phenomenal. I mean, Pedro, I have to say it, and even in front of his kids, so I was with the other week, his son and his daughter, a year ago. And he, you know, actually this summer, we were at Le Mans together, yeah. And I remember, you know, talking about the dad a lot, but Pedro was just a fraction quicker than Joe was. And that was it. I mean, every now and again, Joe would be in front, but generally it was Pedro. And I remember, and not that I ever had any desire to drive with Pedro particularly, because he was somewhat shorter than me, and the thought of battling away, you know, sort of with seat differences. But then I drove with Stuck, so that put that out the window. But whatever it wasn't so easy in those days with the 917, because you couldn't adjust the seat forward particularly. And there was no room in the car anyway. And then, of course, I'll never forget it. I, as I say, I did quite well at Spa that year. And I was generally quite quick in the car. And although I felt I was just learning, because, I mean, Joe Sifford and Pedro were very, 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 very experienced and very good. And I remember John Wye saying, don't worry about them, old boy. He said, you'll get there. You know, not that I wasn't close. It's just that he could see me get out and going, I'm still not quick enough, you know. And you realize that to be a top sports car driver, it was a bit special. You had to get up into that bracket of getting over the nervous, just really like being a top Formula One driver. You had to be very knowledgeable and know how to do it. You couldn't get in it and just go fast. I suppose that would be the thing. You had to take time. And I remember Pedro one day, he came up to me after qualifying. He said, Derek, he said, I think it's time you drove with me. It's lovely. I mean, if ever I could have had an accolade from any of the drivers, that was the first one I ever had. I mean, just fantastic. But of course, sadly, he died. And, you know, the whole bloody thing went out the window with Joe and Pedro dying that year in sports car. Well, Joe was in Formula One, but
yeah,
that was the way it was in those days. Awful. Yeah.
I do remember the BOAC 500 at Brands Hatch. It was pouring with rain, and Pedro was in the car, and they hung a pit board out for him, and it said, "Pedro, it's raining."
Yes. Yes. What they meant was, did you not notice? That's what you mean, I think. He was so good in the rain. I wasn't at that race. Obviously, I was probably doing Formula 2 somewhere else, but because it clashed with Hockenheim. That's why Jimmy had his accident in a way. And at Hockenheim. But so we just watched that race and read about it numerously. It was one of the classic races it was put down as.
It was.
But it was, that car was magical in the rain, because it was quite a flexible chassis, because it was tubular. And, you just come out with all that power and it would just drift so beautifully. But if you didn't know it, you'd be like, oh, my God, what's happening here? But it was special.
One more name. And, of course, the name is Jackie Ickx. Yeah.
Well, where do you want to start? No, I mean, go back. I mean, it's as if I've only met Jackie in the last few years, because it's the only time they've talked about us is some sort of looking into the history of racing, which is rather sad, really. But I met him at Ferrari. I mean, when I met him in Ferrari and in Formula 2. I mean, he drove the Ken Tyrrell and I was driving the Brabham, and he was dynamically quick. And at Ferrari, he was always quick. And he became somebody that I really, we became great friends, but we still are. But it's like which you don't make great friends, but I had so much respect for him and his, the way he handled himself. I realized fairly quickly that he was very, he was quite not nervous. What do you call somebody that, he was,
intense.
He lacked confidence, believe it or not. And he was very shy in a way. So you found it difficult to get to know him. And it wasn't that he had a complex particularly, but he just kept himself to himself. But I just watched him drive, or had watched him drive. I mean, I didn't go out and watch him go around the corners, but I used to watch and I'd look at his results and say, that bloke's bloody amazing. And you saw that wonderful drive at the Nürburgring in an F2 car. But that the F2 car was magic around the ring. It was the most perfectly balanced car you'd ever get. Formula One cars in 1969 and 70 were bloody awful.
Yeah.
There were big tons of things with a bloody great V8 or V12 in the back leaping around. Thing was breaking. But you get in an F2 car, it was designed to go around a racetrack with perfect balance. And it was magical. And we had some great races, obviously, in F2. But Formula One then became more like F2 handling and just had more power. They got better over the years until we are where we are now, really. But he was somebody I used to follow, watch, and invariably followed him because he was always quicker than me. But then he then contacted John, I think, John Y, which was really the first time got to know him properly. And I thought, it'd be interesting to see what happens now. I'm going to be relegated to number two in the car. But he had contacted, he wrote a letter to John, and because John sort of read it to me one day, and he said, I'd like to join Derek Bell, in one of your cars at Le Mans, because Jackie was very shrewd. And I think he realized that the Mirage was going to be the car to beat at Le Mans for all the various reasons. And Jackie would analyze the team, analyze the chances of success in it, and then he'd go for it. And he knew that if he put his name forward, the team would jump at it, because he had this amazing reputation of speed, reliability, and youthfulness.
Yeah.
So when he joined me, I thought, my goodness, we must be in the race with a chance to do all right here. And the whole of that race, he never tried to throw his weight around and show that he was Jackie Ickx. And I always admired him for that. And it completely changed what I had thought about him before, in that he wasn't really interested in his own self. He was interested in success for the car and for the team. And he never got involved with tactics. He never said to John, John, you know me very well. I think you should let me start and let me finish. He said, he's looked at it, he said, under, from what I've seen, I think you should let I'll start the race, he said, and then I think we'll try and work it for Derek to finish. And so that's good, because he also knew that I had a bit of reputation for bringing a car home, you know, because it was 5 years on during my Le Mans career, and I had a bit of reputation of dragging the car across the finish line on three wheels.
Can you try and explain, why were you and Eakes such a special partnership? Because did you each have something the other one didn't have, as it were? I mean, what made Bell and Eakes as successful as they were?
I don't really know. I think it was, I think after that first time with the Mirage, and then we saw each other again over the next 5 years, but without driving together, as far as I remember, till we got to Porsche, and then went out in the Jules car and won again. And I think at that point, I think he realized, and I talked to him about it the other day, literally, we were at the Rennsport in California 3-5 weeks ago. And I said, wasn't it funny? I said, we never talked, did we? And people often say, so how, you know, what do you, Jackie, talk about? I said, I never talked to him. I said, apart from anything else, he was driving if I was out and I was driving if he was out. So we would never talk. But I said, we never even talked tactics. We, for some reason, knew we drove as we knew we had to drive. And I think, I guess we were very lucky that we had a John Wire. And then after that, we had a Norbert Singer. And that's all I can really think about, because we had two very, not stately gentlemen, but certainly the very serious, successful leaders. And whatever they said stuck in our minds, and we knew what they wanted. It's almost like Jackie and I knew how to win, but I couldn't tell you what it was. What would you talk about? Well, we never talked about it. I mean, we knew that. I mean, the only that one time was the end of 1983, and we wanted to, we came in, we're going for a hat trick and of wins. And remember, they brought the car in for the last stint, which I won't go the whole thing, but basically, and Jackie had said, change the brakes. And the front discs are cracked. They were all cracked all the way through. And it was the last hour and a half. And Norbert Singer said to me, he said, you're going to have to drive, you know, he said, we've got to change the brake pads. And I said, so how long does that take? No, discs. I said, how long does that take? He said, it'll take 4 minutes. We're like second, quite a way, a lap behind. And I said, well, so I said, so it'll take 4 minutes. I said, so I said, how long will it take to, you know, just to change the pads? And he said, well, obviously it'll take 30 seconds. So I said, well, we'll just change the pads. Mm-hmm. So he said, are you sure? And I said, yes. So Jackie comes roaring into the pits. They up, I leap in, the car goes up in the air. I'm sitting in it. And when I look out, he is down by the front right-hand wheel, almost hitting the mechanic, saying, get that disc off. You've got to take that disc off. I just should get him out of the way. You know, shriek down the mic, my radio. Get him out of the way. Let me go. And I went off. We won't go into the last hour. And we finished 26 seconds behind. And I believe I broke that record twice in the last hour with no brakes. But I was, you had to change your driving. Jackie and I never discussed it, what we were going to do. And it was only in the last 6 months when I was with him that I told him what I did in that race to try and get the car home. It was really not use the brakes, just use the gearbox. But of course, from 235, you're going to need more than just gearbox to slow down. But remember, we didn't use the gearbox to slow down, because you could change the pads in a matter of seconds, and to change a gearbox took you hours or a long time. So you only learned how to use the brakes to slow down and get the right gear when you got there. And I just changed the method of braking, and was braking in a different manner, warming the brakes up on the straight, hopefully to weld up. The disc sounds absolutely crazy. I was telling him just the other day, this is Hicks, in the last 6 months, and how I got the brakes so hot that, of course, they couldn't jam anymore because they were almost glued together. And in my mind, this was working. Whether engineering-wise it was working, it doesn't matter, because it did work. And we finished 26 seconds behind. Anyway, but so to answer your question, we didn't talk much. We sort of didn't need to, because we knew each other. And we knew each other that well, and we respected that we wouldn't make mistakes. And I don't think either of us ever hit anybody in all the time. Very rarely do we spin, if ever. But I don't know what it was. I mean, I think you'll remember we were in the best car in the world a lot.
That's fascinating, actually. That's a great story. I'm going to mention just two more people quickly before we go on to a different tack. As you said a few minutes ago, he's a very tall man. And he's also a huge character, right?
Yeah, yes.
So you must have had some fun with Hans as well as some racing, yeah?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, no, very much. I mean, he was a laugh a minute, but very serious. I mean, very, very, he is very serious, and which I admired. But that's where he was. Jackie had a great sense of humor, still does. And he gets serious, but he's never really been serious in anything with me, you know, because we just talk about something. And I'll generally agree with him. Say, yeah, that's a good idea. Why don't we do that? And I respect him. With Stucky, I have exactly the same feeling because I have great admiration of his star quality. And the funny thing was, he told me, because this is having been together for two or three years in that period. And he said, you know that Porsche put me with you because they knew that I needed some guidance or somebody with a bit more sense or words to that effect. That's what he told me, or words to that effect. And I mean, it's remarkable, really. And Stucky was just, he would always had a laugh, and you had people like Dieter Questor around him. And I was with him the other day. We did a 356 tour across Austria just 3-4 weeks ago. And it was wonderful. I mean, he was in another car. It was just wonderful. He's so lighthearted. But when he's behind the wheel, he does become a different person. You know, he starts to get very serious. Now, with Jackie, I never got the impression. I always got that Jackie always was like that, always that meant temperament. Stucky, you had to go, hold on a minute, what frame of mind is he in right now? Is he ready? Is he joking with me, or is he deadly serious? With Jackie, I knew straight away. But we never had terribly serious conversations, although they would be, but we'd know when we started that it had to be serious. You know what I'm saying? It's quite, when you don't say you're ready for a joke or you're ready for something serious, you know, it wasn't like that. Stucky was just, the other day, for sake of argument, I was coming across from what we have, the Derek Bell Tour. It's the rally I do in Europe every year. We've done 3 years. And Missy and I flew in early morning from Madrid at 6:30 in the morning. We flew to Zurich. We got off the plane in Zurich airport for somebody to meet us to take us off to this rally at Zürich in Austria, ski resort. We're 48, 356s. So when we're walking out the airport, we've been up since 3 a.m, 4 a.m. to get to the airport, blah, blah, blah. We were knackered. And we literally were sort of coming out of the airport, thousands of people. What a rotten airport, to be honest. And we're coming out, and then we're going, well, who's going to meet us then? And I thought it'd be Andy, the guy that runs the event. And as we come out, suddenly there's this figure, and I'll show you the photograph one day. And suddenly I get out, and of course there's a guy standing there dressed like Guy Fawkes, and he had a big black hat on. He had white hair hanging down either side of his face, and he's holding a stick. He's in a black sort of long suit, and he's holding a stick, and on it says Misty and Mister on it. And he's standing, and I went, and I looked, and it was bloody Stucky. I couldn't believe it. It was hilarious. I mean, it was he's got such a sense of humor, and my flight was 2 hours late, so he'd sat around at that airport looking like an absolute idiot for 2 hours in basically his home country, not worrying about what people thought about him or anything, probably having a laugh. But he was great. I mean, the whole way through, we had a wonderful relationship, still do today. I mean, you know, I had 5 emails from him in the last week saying, hope you're going to do this one, hope we're going to do that one together, you know, and that sort of thing. And the wonderful thing is, both he and Jackie, on different occasions, have thanked me for what we did together. Just got to thank you for all you did to help me win those races. And I've never had that in my life. And I wonder how many people do. I didn't expect it, but it was lovely that the two people that did make a tremendous amount of effect to my life. I mustn't ever forget Al Holwood in America and various other drivers in my career. But those two guys were very special. And of course, we never really had any incidents, so we were lucky.
I wanted to ask you about Stefan Beloff, partly because, you know, every now and then we see a huge talent appear in the sport. And there's no doubt that Beloff is an example of that.
Yeah.
But I wondered whether, from your point of view, Was he a little bit wild? Was he a little bit, did he have a bit of the veal nerve in him or something? I mean,
I obviously knew what you were going to say, but I don't know enough about Villeneuve to know what he was like. All I know is my time with Stefan. Without going on about him, apart from to say how much I like the guy, how much admiration I had for him. He was so fast, delightful. And as you know, our board on it used to say what it used to say, Bell off. And it was Bell and then the Bell part on the board they used to hang out. I think it was that anyway. And he was just out of, he wasn't out of control, but he never knew what the limit was. And I always, because I get asked quite a bit about it, I'm not explaining it terribly well. He was so fast, yet he didn't know why. And everybody seemed to want to see just how quick this boy is. Let's give him everything he can get, see what he can do. And he was quick. But his accident shouldn't have happened, and somebody should have said, "You're leading the race." Remember, we were leading at Nürburgring in that race. Forget the qualifying time. You know that was no. Don't forget it. It was remarkably quick, but he nearly did the same thing in the race. But Nürburgring is the place you can always go around and go a little bit quicker each lap, and if you're allowed to do things like turn boost up and that sort of thing. Which Porsche, I know, at occasions wanted, because they wanted to see just how good was this kid. And I don't blame them. I would have done too. But, of course, you're doing so. You're risking the car in the race. I remember I walked up to somebody in the team in the latter part of that 1,000 kilometres. And we were well in the lead. You know, it was like 45 minutes to go. And I've kept my end up. I hadn't lost a position or anything like that. I hadn't particularly lost any time. And of course, I remember I walked up to this particular guy, a gentleman in the pits, with 15 laps to go. And when he was going quicker and quicker and quicker, and I said, isn't it time to tell him, you know, to ease off, to back off, to take it steady, to easy, or whatever you want to do, the words that we had and put them into German, things that they would put out to me on occasions, okay, hold. That sort of thing. You're doing well enough. We can win like this. Back off. Save the car. Not worth risking. Yeah. And the particular gentleman turned to me and said, "Isn't he brilliant?" And then he crashed two laps later. You said that. Remember, that wasn't the way he died.
No,
that was a year later.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
that
yeah.
was the step, which is now called the Stefan Bell of S's,
yeah.
which is where he crashed. And that pissed me off because I never. I mean, nothing to do with him getting hurt because he didn't get hurt. But I was upset because I really never won at the Nürburgring. I'd be on pole, I got fastest laps, but I could never win. And I mean, it blew up in the Mirage, literally on the last lap, starting the last lap. That's funny. Even the Formula 2 car, in the Formula 2 car in 1970, I was coming up, the long straight all the way back. You go down a dip and out the other side. And as I went down the dip, I backed off the throttle, and that was enough to get reverse thrust in the engine, and it blew up. And I didn't get to the line. I don't know where I finished. But I never won at the ring. So I suppose, so when it came to Stefan and me at the time, or any time I did with anybody, it was like, God, I'd love to win this. But it wasn't desperation. It was just, was like the jewel in the crown. It's almost like winning at Le Mans. And Stefan's crash, I don't think should have happened. I think somebody should have taken him to one side. Of course, people like yourself have said, well, why didn't you talk to him? The problem was, if I had talked to Stefan Bellof, they would have said, he might have. I don't think he would, because I think he's a nice enough boy, lad, gentleman. But somebody might have overheard it or something, but it might have come out later on. But he might have then said, well, of course, Derek Bell told me to ease off, and the other person would say, yeah, but only because you're quicker than him. And it wasn't for that at all. I was trying to win the race, which is really, that was what you said about me earlier. I wanted to win the race, so I would do what I could to win it. Or as John Wilder say, win it at the slowest speed you can. This is not Formula One expertise. But I just regret that Stefan didn't get enough guidance by the right people that he respected. And as I say, if I'd gone and said it to him, well, then he would have probably, he would have said, oh, that was just sour grapes. There he wanted you to spill out.
Well, there's no doubt motor racing lost him far too soon. Derek, let's head to America. You won Daytona 3 times, and you've said in Motorsport magazine in the past that you considered it to be actually a tougher race than Le Mans.
Yeah, why is that, you're saying? Well, because you don't have the straight, which, of course, we have the chicanes there. But when I'm talking about the days that we had a 4 mile, 6 kilometer straight where you could sit back and relax, if you can, at 240 miles an hour. But if as long as the car went straight, which you wouldn't have been in if it hadn't, you would go down the straight. And it was a much easier to drive long, beautiful, fast corners, the most beautiful, smooth surface, to actually go out round Le Mans and be told, okay, go and have a go. It was the most wonderful feeling to give it all the power that it had and drive for it, which I did on a few occasions. Because in the race, often you were reduced. Still had a ton of power, but they were being safe. They want the engine to blow up. But in qualifying, they'd say, go and have a go. And a couple of times, it was just fantastic to literally give it absolute stick the whole way around, use every inch of the road. And of course, as soon as they put chicanes in that, finish that. But it was a wonderful track. But Daytona was obviously great fun. But you know, it's an oval. So you've got an oval with got big bankings on it. So all the time you've got a car that's a compromise, because to go around a banking at 225, or to go and then to go down a straight bit at 200, the car needs different setup, which you can't have it because you're doing it every 500 yards. You're changing from one type of circuit to another. So it's all a compromise. And of course, you've got to remember that at Daytona, we would have sort of maybe 70 to 80 cars on a 3 mile track, whereas at Le Mans, we'd have 55 cars on an 8 mile track. And that's a hell of a lot of difference for overtaking and all the hard work stuff. At Daytona, you'd come into a corner, you had to follow him for two corners before you could get by because of the sort of the way you went from one side to the other. But nonetheless, it was still very exciting and very dramatic to win. But it was quite different. I mean, because we were in the heat, and I mean, there were occasions when, I mean, so you were left without a driver to take over from because they were so exhausted, because it's very, very physical.
What's it like, Derek, on the banking in the night at 200 miles an hour?
Basically, I mean, you probably don't realize this, but the first time I went there was with a 917 with John Wire. And we came from winning in Buenos Aires and came across to Daytona. And the first time I'd ever been on an oval in my life. And of course, it's not only the oval, as you know, it's the infield, which is what we're talking about being wearing. But I remember coming down that back straight when there was no chicane on the back straight at Daytona. So you'd go basically from turns one and two all the way down the back straight into turns three and four flat out. And I remember I went into the track one morning when I had only were testing and nobody there except for our team. I remember watching Joe come down the back straight and go into turn three and turn four. And as he went in there, the car was running almost sort of like that, going around the banking. It was up, I'm going, oh my God. And he's holding it down with so much lock to keep the car from sliding up at the front, long before we got into amazing aerodynamics, because you certainly didn't want, you know, any more understeer going around there. But it was really, really tough. And I would honestly admit, I think I might have only taken that banking flat, but that was would have been at 210 miles an hour. Because in the race, the engine blew up. So we were rather relieved about that. But in the 970 was a very easy car to drive once you got used to it. It didn't have any quirks. It's just that it was beautiful, smooth. And, you know, you had an oversteer coming out of corners and you just had to control it on the throttle. And, you brake. I mean, you adapted very quickly to becoming a good driver in one. But, of course, you know, the fast corner at the end of the back straightaway sort of changed it all completely, because then you had to go in a car that really wasn't suited to it.
Was the Daytona banking in the dark one of those rare moments where you thought, what am I doing here?
In the 917, yes. But, you know, I don't think we got as far as doing the dark, so I was quite relieved. But in the 962s, which, of course, was not quite my next time I did it, I came second 2 years in the 70s in the 935. I came second overall with Bob Akin. And that was pretty mighty to drive one of those, because they were another car, a man's car, if you know what I mean. But then, I drove the 962s, and once I got into those, the car was so good. It was a 962, wasn't it? And it was such a good car and went round there so beautifully, so smoothly. I mean, no lifting off. There would be no understeer that you would just hold it sort of down over a line. I mean, I did have that crash when the right rear tire burst. And that put me up in the air for a while. And I sort of flew quite a long way before I landed. And all I did was get a cut lip. You know, the helmet smacked me in the face as I hit the road. But I had no roof left. The roof was worn away. And my helmet was grazed too, from just churning along on the banking, which is another story. But, you know, they took the car back to Italy or back to Europe, and they had it back 2 weeks later, 10 days later for the next race. Same bloody car I flipped. Unbelievable, isn't it?
I hate to remind you, but you were 53 years old when you nearly won Le Mans for the sixth time in a McLaren.
Yeah.
With your son, Justin, in the car as well, and Andy Wallace. And the weather was terrible. In some ways, was 1995 one of your best ever drives, do you think?
Yeah, probably. I mean, on reflection, yes. Which is very weird because I retired in 94. but I think it was. I think it's because the car really wasn't a race car. I mean, it was a beautiful car. It was never built for Le Mans. I don't think Gordon and I had that in mind at the beginning, although I probably hadn't thought about it. But, I mean, car became a race car when they stuck wings all over it and made it long-bodied and everything and made it a race car. But the car was such a beautiful car to drive. But, I mean, like everybody in that race, there were, I think, five of us in McLarens. I spun, you know, I wouldn't say I didn't spin. But, you know, you're going through corners. What you can't understand with Le Mans is that the water lies there, really, really lies in big puddles. But the problem is, if you come around one lap and go through that water, you aquaplane. And if the next lap you come around, or put it another way, if you come around and you're following three or four other cars, which there are, because there's 50 cars out there, as you come around, they are displacing water in their treads. So you drive through the water in the car in front's wheel marks, obviously, so your car is stable. Then you come around 4 minutes later, 4.5 minutes later, and you have to take the same line, but what line do you take and how fast are you going to go? And that's when you find out that it's an inch deep, or is it half an inch? Or is it only a quarter of an inch? So it's a big gamble the whole time. Unless, you know, if you can get your head around that and say, well, that was quite remarkable. I didn't crash. You know, you're bloody remarkable if you don't go off the road somewhere. And I remember, you know, in the middle of the night, Justin, who, you know, wasn't that experienced at that time. I mean, Justin's doing a hell of a job, as was Andy. Andy was much more experienced. He won Sebring and Daytona and all sorts. Very qualified driver. But Justin's driving the thing, and suddenly he spins. And I remember they brought him in for me to take over because I should only just got out an hour before. And they bring him in because he's completely spooked out. And afterwards, when I spoke with him, he said, "Dad, it was unbelievable. I spun. I just couldn't dare go through that corner again because I don't know why I spun. I don't know what it was." But he had a deep water moment without knowing it, and off he went. And when you do that, you go, but then how fast is fast enough? And you don't know, because every lap you've done has been a different experience. And you go through with one kick and you go through a big lurid quick, and then you do one of those and one of those as you go through, or if you go woof straight through. You know, the public, bless their heart, don't understand what it's like. It's quite amazing. And we were lucky. And we were lucky that we came third, but we should have won. But there was all sorts of various reasons for that. But we deserved to win.
And wonderful to have your son in the same car.
Yeah.
I mean, that,
yeah,
that, you know, that's that, not many drivers get to do that, do they?
No, very few. But certainly not many have got to stand there with their son on Father's Day on the winner's rostrum, along with dear old Andy, that we couldn't have done without. But I mean, there was one stage in that race. And I mean, I just got out of the car when Justin got in there, and he then spooked himself. And they came along to my I thought I had like 3 hours off. And they came to the motorhome and they said, "You're on again." I said, "What do you mean I'm on again?" And they said, "Andy was getting in next." They said, "No, Andy can't." I said, "Well, why is Justin coming?" They said, "Well, he spooked himself and his just lap times have gone to pieces." So they brought him out until the morning. And then he actually had some fabulously good laps during that part. So I was told by the team. But, and so I said, "Well, why can't you put Andy in before?" You know, silly question, really. And they said, "Andy said he can't do it. He's just had it. He's knackered. He's beyond it. He can't get in again." So they got me out of, at least that's the story they told me. I never asked Andy. It might well have been because I seemed to be handling these wet conditions better than anybody else. So they put me, they wanted me back in it again. They might have been right. But whatever it was, I got back in again. But it was still a great experience. And just sad that we had to finish third when we could have won it.
Well, we've done our best to cover at least a fraction of your career, all of which has been followed, as we said earlier, by Motorsport magazine, which, like you, is a survivor. You know, 100 years, not many magazines last for 100 years in sport. I'd ask you the secret of survival, because you must know it, and why you think maybe that Motorsport, which after all is a monthly magazine in this day of social media and satellite television, why it's been such a successful companion to people.
I think, without going on too long, the answer is to say it was always there. We always assumed it would be there. And they stuck it out through thick and thin. And they always were great reporters, great reporting. And it was just perfect. I think a few times they drifted away from what I thought was the meat of the issue. But they've certainly come back and they're there now. And I think it depends on the editor at the time as to where they go. But I thought they've always been a great... I mean, if I see it, I buy it, put it that way. It's just a magazine you need to have. And I've got lots of them lying around in my home here and a home in England. And it's a fabulous magazine, but I think it's also the guys that write for it and the way it's put together.
Well, I think it's a bit like you. You've always been there. You're still here, and we expect you to be here. So that's great. Thank you very much, Derek. That's been absolutely wonderful, and great to see you in the Florida sunshine.
Thank you. Thanks, Rob.
Okay. Thanks, Derek.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.